Welcome to The Point on WCAI. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Sean Corcoran. I'm the news director here at WCAI, and joining me in our Woods Hole studio is Patrick Cassidy. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Sean.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeff Spillane from the Mashpee Enterprise, Jim DeRuiter will call in from the New Bedford Standard Times, and we'll hear from Nelson Siegelman, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And Patrick, let's start off talking about Route 6. Local and state leaders are looking at Route 6, particularly on the Outer Cape, to see if there can be anything done about the roadways there. They've looked at some of the statistics in terms of fatalities and accidents and on that road stretch of road. And of course, this past weekend, there was a big traffic jam after an accident.
Yeah, there were a couple instances over the past week. One last weekend on Saturday where there was an accident, fairly serious, and that really bottled up the road because of where it was, and traffic was backed up for 4 hours, I think even longer than that, for that accident. And then on Tuesday, there was an accident, and that resulted in the death of Wendy Harrison, 54, of Eastham. She was driving a minivan from Cape Cab and crossed over the center line, and that accident again resulted, very unfortunately, in her death. So now state officials and local officials are kind of getting together and talking about this stretch of roadway. Anybody who's been out there knows that it's a stretch of roadway where people are, you know, they're headed out to the Outer Cape. There's a lot of congestion out there once you get out there, and there's not that many options really to get off that road and go around, certainly an accident if it happens. But there's also these instances of intersections where people are getting on and off the roadway, and there can be some dangerous situations out there. So in the last year, there have been 48 vehicle crashes on the road in the Wellfleet area, and there were two fatalities also on that same stretch in August 2013. There have been seven fatalities, including a bicyclist who was hit by a car on Route 6 in Wellfleet from 2007 until Tuesday. And that's just Wellfleet. In Eastham, there had been four fatalities along the road during that same period, and Truro had had two based on our archives and looking through our archives. So State Representative Sarah Peek from Provincetown said that she, in her mind, this can't keep continuing. It can't be business as usual, as she said. And so she sent an email to Wellfleet Town Administrator Harry Turkanian and asked if town leaders would be interested in meeting with state transportation officials and talking about that stretch of roadway and some things that might be done. In some respects, and Turkanian gets at this in the story that we ran in our paper, it's a difficult thing to change because the road, in a lot of respects, has good sight lines. You can see quite a distance ahead of you. But the problem often becomes either inattentive drivers or, again, when an accident happens, there's no real good way in some places to route traffic around it. So not only you have the accident, but you have the aftermath of the accident. Mm-hmm. And again, this last weekend was a prime example of that.
Hours and hours waiting to get around that accident. So you're right. I think they're looking at two issues there. I don't know if there are any clear solutions. There was some discussion, and people should go to the article in the Cape Cod Times, about some possibilities of, hey, maybe we can actually create some roadways that will allow us to do some detouring. There are some paper streets apparently out there that, but of course that would be, anytime you got to do work out in that particular area, the National Seashore is often involved, very complicated. Let's move on. Really terrible, tragic story this week about two young girls Wednesday night who were found, I believe, at the bottom of a pool in West Yarmouth. They nearly drowned, and I understand they're in a Boston hospital, not doing well. But then you had some reporting that showed up in today's paper, in today's Cape Cod Times. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this happened Wednesday night. These two young girls from New York, they were sisters, ages 9 and 12, and they were pulled from the deep end of that pool at Bayside Resort in West Yarmouth, and the pool is 4 to 8 feet deep in different locations, and they were pulled from the 8-foot area. They were not in good shape. They were taken to Children's Hospital, and as far as we know right now, they're still in the hospital, and obviously everybody's pulling for them, but we don't know what their status is at the moment. What we found out yesterday was that the hotel, Bayside Resort, did not have a person on duty who was trained in CPR, first aid, and basic water safety. That's required by Yarmouth Town regulations, and it was several years ago I actually did a story about lifeguards at hotel pools, and it was a surprise to us at the time that lifeguards are not required at public and semi-public pools in the state. They basically leave it up to the town to adopt regulations if they see fit. And on Cape Cod, we've got a lot of hotels and a lot of visitors, obviously, and most towns on Cape Cod do not have any regulations that require lifeguards. The town of Barnstow, I believe, had a pilot program where they were having some basically qualified swimmers is what they called them. And then in Yarmouth, they had a regulation that said you don't need a lifeguard, but you do need two people on staff who are trained in CPR, first aid, and basic water safety. And at all times when the pool is open, you need one of those people to be on duty. In this case, Yarmouth Health Director Bruce Murphy said he went to this particular pool for an inspection, actually Wednesday before this incident, just a routine inspection, and there was somebody on duty with those qualifications. But later that night, when the girls were pulled from the pool, that person was not on duty and nobody else was on duty with that training. So he said they're likely to address this at a Board of Health meeting. But again, it raises questions about how safe it is when you don't have a lifeguard and when the rules aren't followed in terms of having these other qualified individuals around.
Do you know if that was an announced inspection?
I don't know if it was an announced inspection. Mm-hmm. I believe they do the routine inspections, and I don't know if they call ahead and let them know they're coming.
Right.
Bruce Murphy has said he has not had problems with this particular facility. And if you go there, the pool water is clear. He said they checked afterwards. It wasn't an issue with water quality. All other safety features that are required were in place, and it was just a matter of not having that one person on duty. It may have played a part. We don't know. The fact is they did take them out of the pool, and CPR was given by a guest. And according to the police, they were untrained in CPR. And it was the fire department that showed up eventually and took them to the hospital. Again, as of right now, we're not sure of their exact status, but they were in critical condition as of yesterday.
So. Right. And they're 9 and 12 years old. Another story by Patrick this week, actually today, about a teacher accused of abuse in the Barnstable school system, Barnstable Public Schools. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this came up earlier this summer, right towards the end of the school year, I believe. And this teacher at Centerville Elementary School, who was part of the Barnstable Integrated Preschool Program.
What is that?
I think this is a program for integrating students with special needs, and it's basically a special education program. And she was a preschool teacher in that program. She was placed on administrative leave in June after allegations surfaced that she had bullied students, essentially. And I think it's not really clear yet. We haven't gotten a lot of information from the school, from police, or from DCF as far as what exactly happened.
That was interesting to me. I mean, there's three different investigations. The schools have completed their investigation, and then the school superintendent is telling you it's a personnel matter. We can't release any information, despite the fact we have students who have been allegedly impacted by this alleged abuse.
Obviously, we'd always like information. And again, it wasn't just not getting it from the schools. It was also not getting it from the Department of Children and Family Services.
Have they completed their investigation?
They have completed their investigation. They say they've made the appropriate referrals to the district attorney's office. I've checked in with the district attorney's office fairly regularly on this. And again, yesterday, I did not get a call back yesterday. And the Barnstable police have probably been the most forthcoming in terms of saying that our investigation is still ongoing. The allegations are fairly disturbing, and we're working with the district attorney's office to see if we can bring criminal charges. And that's still up in the air as far as criminal charges for this woman. Her name is Cora Schillinglaw. She has been with the school district since 2006. And we tried to get in touch with her to get her side of the story, and to no avail. The Barnstable Public Schools superintendent says that, again, as far as they're concerned, it's a closed investigation. She says that moving forward, she's going to look for more training from DCF officials in terms of reporting this type of abuse, or alleged abuse. Again, this would be raising the question of, okay, well, why wasn't it reported earlier? It seems to have been going on all year long as far as what we've heard.
What do you know? What specifics in terms of abuse or bullying, I think, is the word.
Well, and it seems like it's important to raise the point that working with children with special needs is not an easy job.
Of course
not.
Yeah.
Again, in this case, it sounds like it had to do too, with, from what we're told by some parents who have talked to DCF and gotten some more information than us from them, that it had to do with inappropriate language, had to do with, you know, rough handling of the students. And again, these are situations where sometimes it can be very difficult to handle a child who's having very serious issues themselves. But apparently this crossed the line enough where fellow teachers in the classrooms decided to report it. So that obviously raises some red flags as far as this goes.
Okay, and let's talk about another story, this one out of Yarmouth. Again, we're talking with the Yarmouth Health Director there. In this case, there are some allegations that perhaps some untreated water at a local inflatable park may have led to some bacterial infections on some young children. Now, it's unclear. So some infections were reported. Some skin rashes were reported after a recreation department trip to that particular water park. But it's hard to say if the water park was really, the cause of those.
Yeah, and these reports came from a couple different locations. The Mashpee Recreational Department actually was the department that sent a letter out to the families that they were with. Also, we got a call from a parent who was very concerned about four children who she took to the park, and they came down with rashes, basically. It's the Cape Cod Inflatable Park. The owner of the Cape Cod Inflatable Park, Joe Mararama, was quick to say, hey, listen, there's no proof that this actually came from our park. Yarmouth, again, Health Director Bruce Murphy said, we don't have any proof that this came from the park itself. It could have come from all sorts of locations. Some of these students were in other places. So everybody's kind of being very careful as to not to pin the blame directly on the park. That being said, a lot of these students, all these people who were part of these reports, had gone to this park. The water there is not treated, not chlorinated. It's basically sprayed onto these inflatable slides and into these pools. Bruce Murphy says that there's a lot of exchange with that water, and so he doesn't have he doesn't think that something would stick around if it was in there at all. But he also admitted that the water wasn't tested. So again, you have untreated water, you have lots of children. If somebody did come down with something, there's always the possibility. Obviously, it's something where parents are taking their kids to these places, and there are a lot of kids in one place, and anytime you have that, you're going to have some concerns about passing of different bacteria and other things. But there is, again, no proof as of yet, one way or the other, where this particular set of infections came from.
So the health director is making sure that they're getting the water out of those pools, replacing the water with clean water, that they're deflating the inflatables after hours and sterilizing them to the best that they can, and just really on top of it. Interesting number in there, 900 people were at the park the day that the recreation department brought students there. And so someone's saying, well, that number, you might have more infections than what they're seeing. It was interesting to see that the owner of the park was pretty upset with the Department of Recreation and Mashpee for sending out a letter to parents saying, hey, we've had some cases, it might be from our trip. I don't know. I think maybe the recreation department should be contacting parents when they have concerns like that.
And important to say, they did call him first, and they said they didn't get a call back before they sent the letter out. He says, they never should have sent the letter out. But again, that's something between them right now.
Yeah, you make a good point, Patrick. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, and we're talking about the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Patrick Cassidy. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And waiting patiently on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Well, we all might remember the hailstorm that we saw across much of the Cape, particularly in your area of the Cape, the Chatham-Harwich area. This was, a week and a half ago?
August 7th is the date we were told by cranberry farmers in the area.
Cranberry farmers, okay. So they were affected by this hail.
Well, that's the issue here. Is cranberry farmers from Yarmouth to Orleans say that hailstorm, which was very brief but pretty intense, damaged some 200 to 300 acres of crop The hail, as you said, was very localized, but it couldn't come at a worse time, right when the berries are starting to show up on the vines, and they're kind of at their most vulnerable point right now. These farmers told us that the hail knocked berries off the vines, damaged others. And these damaged berries, they're fearful that they're going to rot and that they could jeopardize what fruit remains on the vines. One Harwich grower said that he was fearful that his entire crop was wiped out by this very brief storm, since he said the damaged berries may not even be acceptable to use for juice purposes, for instance. Farmers contacted the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Services agent for the area, who came down and inspected the bogs and filed a disaster declaration request with the agency. Insurance adjusters were also down inspecting the bogs to assess the damage. Many of these farmers do have crop insurance subsidized through the USDA, but it's limited insurance. It's not going to really make up for the loss of the whole crop, which is why they filed the disaster declaration. At this point, we haven't heard a determination on that declaration. Farmers said they're hoping to at least get something out of that so that this year's crop isn't a total loss. We did hear that Congressman William Keating's office has been apprised of the situation, and they're working with the farmers and the USDA to help facilitate this request. So it could be a bad year for local cranberry farmers if what they fear actually comes to pass.
Okay. Another story this week, reporters and community members got access to the new Monomoy High School. There was a ceremony, a ribbon-cutting ceremony there. Tell us, did you get inside or one of your reporters get inside?
Our reporters got inside for sure, and yesterday was a very festive day over there at the site of the new Monomoy High School, really the culmination of the efforts to regionalize Chapman-Harwich schools, which have sort of been going on for decades, but really came to a head with town meeting votes in 2011. Town, school, and state officials gathered at the new high school to praise the process that produced the new 168,000 square foot school. It's located at the site of the former Harwich High School, which is being torn down even as we speak. Members of the building committee spoke. Senator Dan Wolf, Representative Sarah Peek were there. They both helped facilitate securing state funds, which covered about half of the $49 million construction cost of the new school. Also there were Treasurer Steve Grossman, who's not only a candidate for governor, but he chairs the Massachusetts School Building Authority, which provided those funds. And that group's executive director was there, as well as Congressman Keating. And they all lauded the fact that this 700-student school was built on schedule in about 18 months on budget. Afterwards, there were tours of the new facility, which everybody is very impressed by. Everybody comes out of that just going, "Wow, what a great place this is!"
Sure.
You know, state of the art is a phrase that you hear thrown around all the time, but this school really is the most up-to-date education facility on the Cape, both in terms of technology and its design and just the whole facility. It's really impressive.
Oh, that's great. And of course, it's one of the best districts on Cape Cod, and they deserve a good high school, those kids. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
You too, sir. And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Patrick Cassidy. He's a reporter with the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, I want to ask you about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. It seems like we have to ask this question quite often. What is the status of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station? Is it on? Is it off? Is it partially on? What's going on?
Well, we were a little confused earlier this week because we were told at first that it was offline. And then we were told the next day that no, that was a mistake, that it was back online. And then we were told that they were probably going to be taking it offline again to do some of the work that they needed to do. What happened was, once again, there was a problem with the power station. We've been talking about this for quite some time. There's a crack in a heater that raises the temperature of water fed into the reactor that caused operators to power it down over this past weekend. And the plant was only producing power at 22% capacity at that point. They were also still following up on an event from, I believe, last week where they were having problems. And this, again, is in a long string of problems that the plant has been having. It's an older plant. I mean, it's 40 years old. And that's what a lot of the folks who have wanted to see it shut down have said is part of the problem. You have this aging plant and you're going to have these ongoing problems. And what happens if one of these problems leads to a more major situation? The plant operators say these problems are not a problem for safety. But again, I think a lot of people look at it and say it's not reassuring when you continue to have problem after problem that affects the plant's operation.
Right. And the plant already is under additional scrutiny by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because of problems over the past year or so. So I'm sure we'll continue to discuss the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Let's go to the phone where Jeff Spillane is joining us. He's a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean and Patrick.
Good morning.
Interesting story about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. Of course, the tribe gained federal recognition, I think it was in 2007. I was there for that. And so they've been putting together, now that they're fully federally recognized as an official tribe in the United States, many years after they, of course, have been here, they've been putting together their judicial system. And there were some advancements in that.
Yes, there was. And you know, it's been amazing just to watch and chronicle the development of the infrastructure needed to run a sovereign government, and which has been happening over the past few years. Mm-hmm. And earlier this month, the tribe swore in its first ever district court judge. His name is Jeffrey Madison, and he's actually a member of the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead in Aquinnah out on the Vineyard. He also practices law here on the Cape in Hyannis. And he will be the justice who will be hearing cases on a regular basis here in Mashpee. I was over visiting with him the other day in the new government center, and they have a state-of-the-art courtroom, judicial center. It really is quite impressive. Judge Madison will be hearing cases amongst tribe members, largely dealing with Indian child welfare cases, employment issues, housing issues, and disputes between tribal members.
Yeah, was it clear to you, Jeff, about how they differentiate between what's going to go through the court system, the United States court system or the state court system, and what will end up in the Wampanoag tribal court system?
Well, it's primarily civil cases between tribal members. And, of course, if a tribal member was not satisfied, they could appeal it to one of the Wampanoag Superior Court justices. There are three of those. Or they could take it out of the tribal system. One thing that is interesting here is prior to any case being heard by Judge Madison here in Mashpee, there's every effort made with what's called the peacemaker system. There's a peacemaker's conference room in the Judicial Center where a group of trained mediators, many of which are members of the Elder Judiciary Tribe, try to get both parties to sit down and work out their issues before it goes to the court. And from what I understand, that's been very successful to date.
I see.
And as far as any criminal charges, any criminal cases, none of those can be heard right now. But when the tribe does get its land into trust, they do have an application pending with the federal government for land in Taunton and Mashpee, criminal cases regarding tribe members can be heard and jail time can be sentenced.
Oh, interesting. They don't have a jail that I'm familiar with, though, do they?
They don't, I imagine they will should a casino be built in Taunton, and they could do that here as well.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about the South Cape Village Shopping Center for just a moment. Of course, tell us where that is, and I understand some parts of it are for sale?
Yes, the whole shopping center is for sale. And for those of you who aren't familiar with South Cape Village or Mashpee, a lot of people just refer to it as the Roach Brothers Shopping Center.
Ah.
And it's been open for about 10 years. And it's owned by Charles Tulanian, who owns quite a bit, a sizable chunk of the retail operations on Newbury Street in Boston. And according to his people in Boston, they decided after 10 years that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be in the shopping center business. So it is for sale. It's being marketed by Cushman Wakefield. We could not identify an asking price as of yet, although the assessors in Mashpee have it pegged right around $16 million. The shopping center itself, other than the anchor stores, which would be Roach Brothers and Marshalls, really hasn't taken off. It's been a revolving door of merchants and vendors, restaurants over the years. And so it's really no surprise that this is for sale. But one of the big issues here is that some of the tenants will have to move out rather soon, one of them being the Mashpee Chamber of Commerce, which had been offered free rent at the center. They need to be moved out by next Sunday.
Oh, my.
31st.
Okay. Any plan for them? Do they know where they're going?
It was a surprise for them, obviously. And it looks like Mashpee Commons may be their white knight. They are promising them to work with them and give them some free space, at least temporarily, if not permanently, somewhere in the Commons.
And Mashpee Commons would be the rival shopping area just across Route 28 there.
It sure would. And that being right across from Mashpee Commons didn't help the situation for Southgate Village over the past 10 years either.
I understand. Jeff Spillane is a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise, and he joins us here in the News Roundup on WCAI each Friday morning. Thank you, Jeff.
Hey, you're welcome.
And in our Woods Hole studio is Patrick Cassidy. Of course, he's a reporter with the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Interesting story in the paper this week about Mass Health patients. Of course, Mass Health is the state-run health insurer, usually for typically lower-income folks. But here on the Cape, a lot of people having trouble finding doctors who actually will take Mass Health because the reimbursements are much lower and all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, there was a report last month by the Massachusetts Medical Society. It showed that only 40% of family practitioners and 46% of internists in Barnstable County reported taking MassHealth. That's compared to 70% and 66% respectively for each of those categories on an average in Massachusetts. So obviously it's much lower here on the Cape. And that's in spite of the fact that across the state there's been an increase in primary care doctors taking MassHealth, up 6% for family physicians and 12% for internists in 2013. Here on the Cape, the bottom line is that we have a shortage of primary care doctors. And throughout the story by Cindy McCormick that ran earlier this week, that seemed to be what everybody kept coming back to. And you know, there's logistic issues. And one of the things that people were saying, well, is if you let folks kind of decide when they were going to take it and when they weren't, it's kind of a all-in or not in terms of taking it. So you could, if you let them kind of opt out of taking it, they could kind of manage their practice a little better at different times, but then still be open to taking some patients who are using MassHealth.
I see. So right now, if you're a doctor and you have a small practice, you may decide, look, I can't just accept all MassHealth patients because you may be inundated with patients, and you can't. And then if you're going to take it, you'd have to take them all, or you can't just stop and take like a certain percentage. So some are saying, if we change those rules a little bit, maybe you'll have more doctors participating.
Yeah, they're looking for more flexibility. I think what you can do is stop taking MassHealth patients, but it takes 3 months to basically get to that point where you can stop. So during that time, you keep getting inundated with those patients, and again, you're not able to manage your practice.
And the reimbursements are lower. Often those patients require much more attention than other patients, so doctors have some, it would seem, probably legitimate issues. There was some bright news right at the end of that story about the kids, about pediatrics.
Yeah, and I think that had to do with getting having shorter wait times in terms of getting into see a doctor. So that was, again, the one bright spot. But I think overall the takeaway was we just don't have enough primary care physicians.
Let's talk to Jim DeRuda. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Let's talk about mental health. I know the paper's been doing paying a lot of attention to some mental health issues. I think this week you're talking about stigma, and you're talking about how the state actually approaches mental health treatment.
Right. We had Mark Pacheco come, a senator for Bristol and Plymouth Senate District, come in and speak with us specifically about mental health. And you know what he had to say was that it's just a sad commentary that our mental health system today is our prison system. Basically, nationwide and statewide, more than half of the inmates in our federal, state, and county correctional institutions have mental health issues. About 20% of them are nonviolent in the three counties that make up southeastern Massachusetts. And he's right. It's expensive. It's unfair to the mental health patients. It's just the wrong way to treat mental health.
Does Representative Pacheco know of any legislation that offers some answers to this or some different possibilities for treatment?
Well, he told us that we asked him, is there any way to say how much more expensive it is to treat mental health patients in the correctional system than it is in the mental health system, in the public health system?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that they had formed a commission and asked a contractor to get the answers to this, and he said about three-quarters of the way through the commission period, he hadn't heard anything. So he called the contractor up, and they weren't even following the directives that created the commission. And there were problems with that because the contractor has contracts with the Department of Mental Health, and now they're being asked to make a sort of critical report on provides their bread and butter.
Sure. And as Patrick Cassidy talking, it seems especially important at a time to deal with this at a time when the state is closing down beds as far as mental health patients go, and it seems to be parallel to the idea of potentially like some sort of diversion program they have with drug issues. I mean, if somebody has a mental health issue, I wonder if anybody's ever thought about, again, a diversion program. Obviously, if you've committed a crime, it falls into a different category. But, you have these different services that are now being provided, whether it's drug addiction services, mental health services within the jails. And it seems like more and more that's where people who need these services are ending up.
What about that, Jim? Any talk about a diversion program?
Well, one thing that's been talked about a lot is trying to start to get at people with mental health issues much sooner,
mm-hmm.
before they become criminals.
Right.
There are lots of services available in the communities, but not enough. Just as you were talking a few minutes ago about reimbursement for Medicare, reimbursement for mental health is supposed to be on parity with physical health, according to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, but it's not. And the insurance companies are quite adept at finding ways to put off reimbursing on parity. If they did, there'd be more money for services in the communities, and there'd be less expensive treatment of mental health.
Yeah, you talk about getting to people early. I know we've reported here on the Cape, it's very difficult to get any type of mental health services for young children, and particularly psychiatric services are very difficult to come by. Let's move on to the next story, and we just got to talk about this one briefly. A Dartmouth selectman named John George is in some trouble he's a bus company owner, right?
Right. I'll do my best to be brief about this, Sean.
Okay.
He's a selectman, a former state representative, a farmer, and owner of a bus company. He resigned from the legislature after 6 months because he purchased this bus company, which had a contract with the Southeastern Regional Transit Authority. And it's turned out that he's under federal indictment now because of, embezzlement, improperly receiving a pension from SRTA, having SRTA employees work on his personal farm during work hours, using SRTA vehicles for out-of-state shopping trips, and using SRTA funds to buy cell phones and internet connections for friends.
Okay, so he's been indicted for those alleged infractions. Is he still sitting as a selectman?
He is, and he says, why should I step down from selectman? I'm not guilty.
Well, the governor of Texas has been indicted. He's
right.
Staying in office. Well, I'm sure you'll continue to cover that. I appreciate that. Jim DeRuta is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. And you can follow the editorial page on Twitter at OpinionSCT. That SCT is for South Coast Today. Jim, we appreciate your input today.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll speak with Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Patrick Cassidy, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone is Nelson Siegelman. He's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Morning,
morning.
Good morning to you. So we've been talking a lot about, of course, the presidential family on Martha's Vineyard, and interesting story, of course, in the paper this week, in your paper, The Times, about a former president, we're not talking about Clinton, but another president going way back who also visited Martha's Vineyard.
Yes, 140 years ago, a lot of people may not know this, but the first president to visit Martha's Vineyard was Ulysses S. Grant. He came with his wife and a group of guests in August, and he had himself, you know, pretty good time. It was 1874. The island was a very quiet place. It was a very small resort, and he came by steamer. And interestingly, during his three-day stay, he made trips to Nantucket, Wellfleet, Hyannis, and Woods Hole. But he attracted quite a crowd. In this account, at one point there were close to 30,000 people who had crammed onto the island to come and see Grant, who was, of course, quite a hero, having been the man who, as one author said, the man who saved the Union. But he was a very interesting person and a man of few words as well, which is really sort of interesting, I suppose, a departure from current standards.
So does the research indicate that he was the first president to visit the vineyard?
Yes. Oh, yes. He was the first. And
have there been others, I mean, besides Clinton and the Obamas that we know of?
Not that I've come across.
Okay.
Perhaps some historians out there will be sending me emails soon, but none that I've heard about. One of the things I found really interesting about Grant, I ended up doing a bit of writing. There's a wonderful book by an author, H.W. Brands, The Man Who Saved the Union. And Ulysses S. Grant was the first president to pass a Civil Rights Act, and he was quite adamant in terms of trying to protect the rights of the freed slaves, and went to great efforts. In fact, he sent Union troops into the South to try and protect them from the Ku Klux Klan. Now, he wasn't successful, really, and he was fighting a great deal of prejudice that existed at that time, but I think a lot of people think of Grant as someone who was a general or perhaps somebody who was a drinker, but that part of his legacy is probably not as well publicized as it ought to be.
Another story that you have this week is about the agricultural fair, which marks its 20th anniversary?
It's the 20th anniversary at the new fairgrounds, but this is the 153rd annual fair. It used to be at the smaller site, what we call a Grange Hall, and 20 years ago the Agricultural Society was given a very large piece of land and they built a new barn there, and that's where the fair has been. And it's a lot of fun. It's lots of food, lots of rides, lots of exhibits, and islanders and visitors display their various crafts. So it's a really wonderful family time. I think anybody that's never been to it should certainly experience it, and it goes through till Sunday, and it's a lot of fun for everybody involved.
All right. Nelson Singelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and he joins us from the Times newsroom. Thank you very much, Nelson.
You're welcome.
Okay. Patrick Cassidy is here in our Woods Hole studio of WCAI, and he's a reporter with the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Patrick, there was a story this week about what's being called a reform bill that I believe has passed, which is going to place, if changes aren't made, going to place some police reports completely off limits to media and public scrutiny.
Yeah, and this is a domestic violence reform bill. It was signed into law August 8th by Governor Patrick. It had a lot of support out there. There were some compromises along the way, and it was largely inspired by the death of Jennifer Martel, who was fatally stabbed in August 2013 by her then-boyfriend Jared Remy. Of course, this got a lot of media attention because Remy is the son of Red Sox broadcaster Jerry Remy, and he had a history of abuse. And so domestic abuse victim advocates said, you know, some changes were needed to really stop these types of events from occurring and get at issues earlier. But one section of that bill removes police reports on domestic violence from the public record. there are already instances where police reports are removed from the public record, usually having to do with sexual assault cases. This, though, takes it another step, and in terms of domestic violence reports, removes those from the public records. And as somebody who goes out to court every week, at least once a week, if not more, and looks through the court files, there are a lot of domestic violence cases out there. And quite often what you'll find is there's redactions of victims' names in those cases and of witnesses' names. But the reports are actually there, so you can get a sense for what's going on in your community. You can get a sense for if this is somebody who is of a certain, you know, stature, a political figure, there's a way to get at information. This would take that particular piece of information away. Advocates of the First Amendment say this is another line of removing public records from being able to be viewed. And actually, some local police departments have posted things on Facebook asking their constituents how they feel about it. Harwich Police Chief William Mason said he'll follow the law, but he doesn't like it. But again, advocates for victims of domestic violence say it's needed so that domestic violence victims will feel comfortable coming forward. Other folks argue that they're going to come forward no matter what. So there's some talk about whether or not some amendments will be made and will change that piece of the legislation. It was interesting to us to find that a lot of the legislators who signed on to it, including locally, didn't really have a firm grasp that that was what was happening. And I think
I got that sense, not just from the legislators, but even from some of the advocates for it saying, yeah, this isn't quite as clear as it could be. Maybe there will be some changes. So I didn't get the sense that anyone's really 100% happy with this change.
Well, and I think Amy Anthony, who reported this story, she spent quite a lot of time calling up people and just asking them if that's exactly what was going to happen. I mean, the language is there. We're able to read it, but it's not particularly clear. And we were finally able to get folks and some of the sponsors of the bill to say, yes, the police reports will be removed from the public record. Once you're arraigned, information becomes available. But the police reports within the court files wouldn't have been there. And again, there are people who aren't necessarily happy with it. It's hard to, you know, argue against a domestic violence reform bill overall and against protections for victims of domestic violence. But this is a case where you're essentially taking the perpetrators of that violence and shielding them from public scrutiny as well. And so there's right. A lot of questions as to whether that's.
I mean, I've done stories about public officials, Board of Selectmen, who have been charged with domestic violence, and those reports would not be available. I know certainly the Cape Cod Times has done numerous stories about police officers who have been involved in domestic violence, have reported those stories for months and months as different incidents have come up, and you learn more about what's happening with this particular officer. And those reports would not be available anymore. So I think there really is, you know, maybe it's, you know, I'm a journalist, so I got this First Amendment thing that I'm kind of hung up on.
Yeah. We may be a little biased in that respect, but we're biased because, again, it's something where we get information that we then are able to share with our readers and
right.
about, again, people who they're electing to office, who they're paying with public money, and who are potentially involved in these types of incidents. So
let's talk about a discovery here in Falmouth. A body, a skeleton was found in B.B. Woods on Tuesday, or maybe it was Monday, that body was found, and they've identified who that person was. And I bring this up because many of us had seen the missing posters around town for this individual, Gerald Farley.
Yeah, and it was the body was actually found Sunday evening, but it okay. didn't really come to light that the police were out there until Monday. They found what the district attorney, Michael O'Keefe, said was virtually complete skeletal remains of a human body. At the time, they said that they had a pretty good indication of who it was. They also said there was no indication of foul play. And like you said, Gerard Farley he's 58 years old, and he had been missing for quite some time, and I think about a month. And he was somebody who seemed to be, you know, known in the community. He was known at the local library. He was somebody who loved walks in the woods, and he loved getting out and around Falmouth. And unfortunately, his body was found. There's still an investigation into what is going on, but at this point, the district attorney says he does not believe that there's any foul play involved.
Real tragedy on Nantucket this week. Joshua Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer-Mirror couldn't join us this morning, but Patrick, you had the story in the paper newspaper as well. The Cape Cod Times had the story as well about a Scituate man who died on the vineyard after diving into the harbor. It was a pretty late night event.
Yeah, this is Corey Griffin, and he's a 27-year-old. He was somebody who was actually very involved with the recent ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, and he was a good friend of Peter Freight's, who essentially kicked that off, at least in our area. I think it started down in New York. And at about 2 a.m., police were called to 44th Street Wharf on the harbor for a report of a man missing in the harbor. A lifeguard who was nearby and happened to be, he was off duty, obviously, at 2 a.m. in the morning, but happened to be working nearby, dove in, and after several attempts was able to pull Griffin from the water. Officers performed CPR, but he did not survive. We had talked to family members, and it was actually interesting. I think family members and friends really understood after his death that it was important to talk about him and talk about how active he was and how dynamic he was in terms of fundraising. And he had just been fundraising for the ALS Challenge and had helped raise, I believe, $100,000.
Wow.
And there's some indication that he may have been essentially celebrating, you know, that good fortune and people being so generous. And again, unfortunately, he died in this instance.
We'd been looking for in Hyannis, they'd been looking forward to having a museum, a pirate museum, potentially going in the Armory building, a building that's been around a long time, been involved in a lot of different historic things, including the John F. Kennedy election and all that. And so this pirate museum was coming, but no.
Yeah, everybody was very excited about this over the last year or two. This pirate museum, which was proposed by developers Charles Doe Jr., Robert Carlton, and then Barry Clifford, who discovered the wreckage of the pirate ship Whydah off Wellfleet in 1984 and is well known in our area for all his work hunting for different pirate ships, and he's doing this across the world. And apparently the deal between these folks didn't work out. They had gotten the lease from the town, and they had it all set up. They were expected to open actually this year. That had been delayed because they needed some legislation. But during that delay, apparently there was some back and forth between Doe specifically and Barry Clifford. According to Clifford, Doe had basically asked that the artifacts that Clifford was bringing to the museum be put up as collateral in order to get some financing for the project. And Clifford said, absolutely not. Oh. I'm not doing that. If you do that and something goes wrong, these could be sold off. I don't sell my artifacts that I find. We want people to be able to come and see these. Obviously, Doe's attorney said they have a different take on things, that there were other issues, especially with their assurances that Clifford could actually provide the artifacts that he was promising. Clifford said, I can totally do that. So obviously, this was a deal that fell apart. It seems like it might have also fallen apart just around the financing and how much it was going to cost to do this. So now the town is going to have to take a second look at what they do with that location.
Okay, and well, we may not have a pirate museum, or we will not have a pirate museum, but the Falmouth Road Race will continue on. Had the 42nd running of the road race this past Sunday, and tell us about the results of that. And of course, I'm interested in this story about this 11-year-old New York resident who did the wheelchair division. He was a participant in the wheelchair division.
Sure, and I know you were running in it, Sean. So you weren't as concerned with other people's times. You were just flying by people. And
I certainly didn't see the winners.
Well, maybe the backs of them at the start.
Right.
It was as is often the case with the road race. It was two Kenyans who came in the front. Stephen Sambu and then Betsy Sena. They won. And then in the wheelchair division, it was James Sabata and Tatiana McFadden. Is very well known as a Paralympian, also running in the rolling in the race essentially was 11-year-old Jason Robinson, who the race organizers had told us was the youngest wheelchair competitor. That's not true, as it turns out. And today we have a story in the paper about Jamie Leggett. He was 7 years old in 1994 when he competed in the wheelchair portion of the race, and we heard from his mother pretty quickly, as any good mother would do, and she said he was actually the youngest. So we have a lot more in today's story about
it's a nice
Jamie.
Story in today's paper, and I encourage folks to go read it. Thank you, Patrick Cassidy. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times, and he joined me in our Woods Hole studio. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow Patrick on Twitter at PCassidy, CCT. Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeff Spillane from the Mashpee Enterprise, Jim DeRuta from the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.